Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, March 27, 2018. Human Rights Watch says South Sudan could be at a turning point after IGAD announced it's ready to impose sanctions.
You know, it's positive to see that the threats and the language that we saw earlier in January has now been followed up with concrete decisions. What remains to be seen is, of course, how the decision will be implemented.
And South Sudanese continue to struggle for clean water.
Actually, the project started in 2013, but due to some crisis that happens in between, it has been off and on until the recent crisis that's in July 2016 that paralyzed everything.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The New York-based Human Rights Watch says pressure is mounting on violators of human rights in South Sudan. Human Rights Watch researcher Jehan Henry is applauding IGAD's recent announcement of its intention to impose sanctions on certain individuals who have blocked the peace process in South Sudan. Henry tells Ayen Deng Bior she hopes this is a turning point for South Sudan.
This is a new step, definitely, from coming from IGAD. It is not, however, the first time the AU has imposed sanctions on individuals. There have been a couple of other situations. So it's not unprecedented. But it is the first for South Sudan through this mechanism. So one of my responses to that is, you know, it's positive to see that the threats and the language that we saw earlier in January has now been followed up with concrete decisions. What remains to be seen is, of course, how the decision will be implemented. And we are certainly looking at that closely. The AU has played a really important role in South Sudan. The AU's Commission of Inquiry, led by Obasanjo, was an extremely thorough accounting of the early part of the civil war, and of course laid the groundwork for the hybrid court, which has been envisioned in the peace agreement. And so we hope that the AU and IGAD will continue to play a constructive role in taking these necessary steps toward some accountability for everything that's happened.
I want to read the line from the IGAD communique about these sanctions. So it says that IGAD decides to, quote, take targeted sanctions against individual violators and refer to the AU Peace and Security Council for appropriate punitive measures, as you said before. Now, this is not very specific. For you, as a South Sudan researcher and as a human rights researcher, what do these lines say to you?
It is not specific, but that does not mean that there isn't information implicating individuals on record through the CTSAM work. And there are a number of other sources, but I believe the IGAD communique really is talking about the CTSAM monitors. And to refer it to the AU, PSC means to ask the AU to go ahead and impose individual sanctions, just like they proposed in Burundi, and they have implemented in other situations. So we'll see what happens. You know, it doesn't surprise me that the IGAD communique doesn't name anybody, but it charts out a course for action. And that looks like a positive step in the sense of IGAD at least following through on what it had previously said. And it underlines the growing frustration that we've seen internationally over South Sudan's leaders' total inability to bring a stop to all of this violence against civilians in the country. And that frustration is reflected in IGAD statements, in AU statements, in U.S. unilateral arms embargo, and in UN Security Council statements, including the recent mandate renewal resolution for UNMISS, where the UN basically said that an arms embargo could be imposed if things don't change.
That was Jehan Henry, researcher at the Human Rights Watch, speaking to Ayin Deng Bior from New York. IGAD's Council of Ministers also spoke yesterday about Riek Machar, saying the opposition leader's house arrest in South Africa should be lifted immediately if Machar renounces violence. In its communique of the 61st extraordinary session in Addis Ababa, the Council also reiterated its conviction that durable solutions are the only way out of what it calls South Sudan's extremely grim political and humanitarian situation. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
The warring parties have conducted two rounds of peace talks without successfully signing a final deal. In today's communique, the IGAD Council of Ministers said it decided to take targeted sanctions against individual violators and refer to the AU Peace and Security Council for appropriate punitive measures. The Council says SPLM-IO leader Riek Machar's house arrest should be lifted as soon as possible, on condition that he renounces violence and not obstruct the peace process. If those conditions are met, the Council says, he should be allowed to relocate to any country outside the region, but not neighboring South Sudanese countries. Wani Michael, the executive director at OK Africa Foundation, says South Sudan's peace mediators must heed IGAD's special envoy to South Sudan, Ambassador Ismail Wai's recommendations, and put pressure on the warring parties to make peace this time around.
It is time that IGAD have to show to South Sudan that they are not promoting the conflict, because the South Sudanese back home in Juba and elsewhere have lost faith in the IGAD-led peace process, and I think it is time for them to redeem themselves.
Manasseh Matiang, a peace activist with the Juba-based Anataban organization, says IGAD should take clear steps to ensure that peace violators are punished.
One is that the IGAD draws up and enforces a number of punitive measures against individual violators and spoilers of peace and entities that have failed to submit names of individuals responsible for violation of the cessation of hostilities agreement.
The cessation of hostilities agreement was signed in December 2017 during phase one of the talks, but has been violated repeatedly by both warring parties. Matiang says the ceasefire and transitional security arrangements monitoring mechanism, or CITSAM, must clearly identify individuals and other parties that violate the cessation of hostilities agreement.
We also recommend that CITSAM releases reliable reports on implementation of the agreement on cessation of hostilities by parties, with clear reflection of all events that have taken place since the adjournment of the second phase of the HLRF, and make concrete recommendations to the IGAD Council of Ministers on the same.
Michael says the IGAD must also ensure adequate representation at phase three of the talks with all sectors of South Sudanese society, including the youth.
I expect that also they should be able to fundamentally discuss the issues of young people, how the youth can meaningfully participate and get represented into the negotiation, I mean into the discussion itself. We saw in the first and the second phase of the HLRF, the youth are not engaged as negotiators.
The Council of Ministers says mediators will undertake shuttle diplomacy with the parties to reconcile the position of the parties on responsibility sharing and permanent security arrangements, two of the major sticking points, before the next forum. It is also urging all South Sudanese participating in the forum to engage in good faith and to resolve all outstanding issues to achieve the objective of the revitalization of the 2015 peace deal. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Thousands of South Sudanese struggle every day to access clean water. British charity Oxfam says Juba residents in particular have a hard time accessing drinking water despite abundant water in the capital. Wake Simon Wudu has the story for VOA from Juba.
That is a water tanker pouring water into a 250-liter water tank in Juba's Gurey residential area. Atilabara resident Margaret Victor says people in her area and other places like Gurey struggle to access clean drinking water on a daily basis. Victor says since she settled in the area 7 years ago, her family has bought water from the tankers, water that comes directly from the Nile River.
For purpose of drinking, they are not clean. It has a lot of bacteria. Sometimes it brings diarrhea. Sometimes also it transfers cholera.
To try to prevent contracting waterborne diseases, Victor either boils the water or treats it with chlorine tablets. But she says buying water from tankers can get expensive for a family like hers, which needs at least 3 drums or 750 liters of water every day to wash, cook and bathe.
Yeah, we spend too much actually, because now these days water is the price of waters have been high because of the economic situation. Now one barrel in our area it's 200 SSP.
Many South Sudanese families cannot afford to pay 200 South Sudanese pounds for water each day. Oxfam's campaigns advisor in South Sudan, Elizabeth White, calls Juba's water and sanitation problem severe. She says the government and aid organizations have neglected the water sector, even though widespread health problems such as malnutrition and cholera are directly linked to an inadequate supply of clean water. White says most households in Juba and other urban areas spent at least a third of their monthly income on buying water, compared to 5% for most places around the world.
The economic situation, the inflation that we've been seeing increasing year on year since December 2013 means that the price of everything has become more expensive. What that means in terms of the cost of water and water treatment is that water treatment itself is more expensive to do. The cost of fuel for vendors to take that water to consumers, to citizens, has increased. The cost of spare parts, these kind of treatment plants really take a lot of maintenance. All those prices have increased, as has the cost of living.
The Japan International Cooperation Agency, or JICA, spent 4 billion Japanese yen, or about $38 million, to establish a water treatment plant in Juba. The plant could supply 10,800 cubic meters of clean drinking water a day through 120 public water taps and 80 truck filling stations. Tombe Sebitlako, assistant program officer at JICA, says things were going well until the conflict broke out.
Actually, the project started in 2013, but due to some crisis that happens in between, it has been off and on until the recent crisis that's in July 2016. That paralyzed everything.
The South Sudan Urban Water Corporation is a government entity that is required to supply clean water to residents of Juba and other major towns. Engineer Osama Mahadi manages the Juba Water Station, which is supposed to supply 7,200 cubic meters of clean water each day to Juba residents, but Osama says it can supply only 3,500 cubic meters each day, or less than half that amount.
We are not meeting that capacity due to lack of fuel and some chemicals like aluminium sulfate and chlorine for the treatment of water. And also the fuel, as we were using the generators as a source of our power, so we are these generators are using diesel. And most of the time we are facing some challenges to find enough diesel to run the station for 24 hours.
White says the UN and other aid agencies received only 35% of the money they needed last year for water, sanitation and hygiene in South Sudan. The same groups say they received 68% of the money they needed last year for food aid. White says the continuing conflict and economic challenges in South Sudan hamper efforts to provide safe drinking water, but she says there are things the government and aid agencies could do to vastly improve access to clean water.
Replication of the kind of water treatment plant we've done in Gumbo would be really effective. It's solar powered, which instantly makes it kind of less vulnerable to that economic crisis. It's not dependent on the price of fuel. So therefore, it's cheaper to treat the water and therefore cheaper for people to buy it.
White says it is also important for donors to designate that their dollars be spent specifically on accessing clean, safe water and improving sanitation. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Kenya imports doctors from Cuba. Find out why when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you believe Africa can do without aid from Western powers? Why or why not?
Yes, we have so many things. We are blessed as Africans. We have fertile soil. Without even applying like manure or something of that kind, you can still plant. We have so many things that can earn us living without getting aid from the Western countries.
Africa with no aid from US, I think it's a big no. We are not yet there.
Africa has everything it needs. We have a population. We also have resources. What we need is actually leadership and a change of the value system.
Africa can do it. Africa is capable of doing without that aid. One country, Libya, if Libya was able to do it without the Western aid, we are all able to do it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we are talking about a deal the Kenyan government made to import Cuban doctors. Kenya has agreed to accelerate a health agreement it signed with Cuba last year to bring 100 doctors from Cuba to fill gaps in Kenyan hospitals. 50 Kenyan doctors will also be sent to Cuba for specialized training. Rahel Ombur has this story for VOA from Nairobi.
The Kenyan government says the deal to import Cuban doctors would help counter gaps in Kenya's medical facilities. Kenya Cabinet Secretary for Health Cecily Karioki explains.
The target is to bring 100 specialized doctors from Cuba. One, because of the HR resource gap that we have. We are careful not to cloud the place with general doctors, and therefore the aim of my ministry is to bring forward critical care physicians at that level, family physicians, physicists, oncologists, and surgeons dealing with plastic reconstructive surgery, dealing with orthopedic surgery, and dealing with neurosurgery.
Each Kenyan county is expected to get at least two of the specialist doctors. But Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union Chairman Samuel Oroko says the move will not address the systemic dysfunction in Kenya's health system.
There are no drugs, theaters are not functioning, laboratories are not functioning. So even if they come and the system is not functioning, they're coming just to be painful. And they may not get equipment to use to train our own. So we need to look at all angles of our health system. Don't just bring in because of bringing in. Also ensure the system is functional. As they come, they can also operate.
The agreement will also see Kenya work with Cuba on collaborative research projects, training for healthcare workers, and collaborations in fields such as genetic engineering and biotech work. Former Kenyan Minister of Medical Services, Professor Anyang Nyong'o, visited Cuba and says Kenya will benefit from the agreement.
But as a health minister, I came here and we were trying to work things together, and I actually proposed some things that we need to do. For example, malaria vector control, collaborating with the Teaching Engineering Biotechnology Center and all that. But unfortunately, we didn't get far. What gives me satisfaction this time is that The president is determined that we implement these long-standing proposals of collaboration between us and Cuba.
Oroko says the medical union is not against any collaboration or partnership with other governments.
Our appeal and our advice is as we consider to bring in expertise from other countries, we need to exhaust what we have locally, and if we lack capacity locally, then we should focus on training our own so that they can be used to manage our patients in Kenya.
The union says more than 1,200 Kenyan doctors have been unemployed since May 2017.
Equally, we do have a number of doctors who have qualified, both general practitioners and specialists who are not being employed and they are Kenyan.
Karaoke says there are plans to absorb the graduate doctors into the healthcare system, but she says Kenya will still not be able to meet the recommended doctor-to-patient ratio. Oroko says about 4,300 doctors work in the public sector for Kenya's 38.6 million people.
There is the required number of doctors they are supposed to have as a facility, and that is public knowledge. The WHO requires to have one doctor per 1,000 patients in any given population. Currently, Kenya, we only have one doctor per 24,000. Where are they going to get the money to pay the ones coming from Cuba?
The union blocked attempts by the government to bring in doctors from Tanzania at the height of its three-month strike last year. The agreement ending the strike called for pay increases and medical risk allowances. Ryle Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move to Uganda. In 2005, four young Congolese refugees in Western Uganda opened a school for kids like them who had been separated from their families when they fled conflict in neighboring countries. Today, the school counts about 500 students and continues to provide free education to refugees who are unaccompanied or whose families cannot afford to pay. Halima Athumani reports from Changwale Refugee Settlement in Western Uganda.
Just come running. Please, they are beginning from here. You see that?
A physical education class is going on at Koburos Primary School. The school name is a combination of Congo, Burundi, Uganda, Rwanda and Sudan, the countries of origin for refugees living in Western Uganda. The school was named by its founders, four teenagers living at the Changwale Refugee Settlement.
And so with the friends, we thought maybe we can find ways to bring new hope in our community. And that's when we started creating Koburos International Youth Organization Transform Africa.
The boys did manual labor to raise money. Joseph Munyambaza, now 27, remembers that with the first $150 they earned, they bought textbooks for the initial 16 students.
We used to work in the community, work for farmers, and then they give us small money, which we'd use to buy textbooks and other materials for the most needy children. And they, among ourselves, could serve as tutors. We now have our own farms. So we farm, and then when the crops get ready, we use the product for food.
The school also sells some crops from the farm to cover costs, and families that can afford it are encouraged to pay about $16 in fees. Outside donations help cover the teacher's salaries. The first class was held under a tree that still stands in the school compound. The school now boasts of four classroom blocks, serving 500 children from lower to upper primary classes. At the Changwale Refugee Settlement, many residents have lived here for about 7 or 8 years. They say they won't return home to Congo until stability is assured. Okoboy John Bosco, the head teacher at Koburos, says the school has helped refugee children build new lives.
Some of them are as early as the age of theirs now. They are talking of some early projects that can venture into help the community. So I see there's a really big change that has taken place in their lives. And I think the long-term change is yet to come as they pursue their studies. And I believe with such initiatives now within the refugee settlements, I think the best can be achieved from these kids.
10-year-old Ketrasha Traori Ibambas is in primary six.
I want to be a doctor because the people in this community are suffering from cholera and they are lacking doctors. So I need also to be a doctor so that I can be able to prevent any other diseases.
The school may soon see more new students. A fresh wave of communal violence in the northeastern DRC has pushed tens of thousands of Congolese refugees into western Uganda this year. The UN says most of the new arrivals are women and children. Halima Athmani for VA News, Changwali, Uganda.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Human Rights Watch is applauding IGAD's recent announcement of its willingness to impose sanctions on certain individuals who have blocked the peace process in South Sudan. Human Rights Watch researcher Jahan Henry says she hopes this is a turning point for the people of South Sudan. She says it's a new step for IGAD, but it's not the first time the African Union has imposed sanctions on individuals. Henry says while it's encouraging to see that the threats made back in January are being followed up with concrete decisions, it remains to be seen how those decisions will be implemented. The IGAD Council of Ministers says Riek Machar's house arrest in South Africa should be lifted immediately. In yesterday's communique of its 61st extraordinary session in Addis Ababa, the council said Machar's house arrest should be lifted as soon as possible on condition he renounce violence and not obstruct the peace process. If those conditions are met, the council says, he should be allowed to relocate to any country outside of the region, but not to any neighboring countries of South Sudan. The warring parties have conducted two rounds of high-level forum talks without signing a final deal. The council said it decided to take targeted sanctions against individuals violating the peace process and referring to the AU Peace and Security Council for appropriate punitive measures. Wani Michael, the executive director at OK Africa Foundation, says South Sudan's peace mediators must put pressure on the warring parties to make peace this time around. And finally, David Shearer, the special representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan, says the UN is working with Junglee state officials to help internally displaced persons sheltering at a UN-run camp in Bor return home. Governor Philip Aguirre says he has formed a committee to facilitate their relocation back home. Shearer visited Bor today, where he met Aguirre and other top state officials. Governor Aguirre says state authorities stand ready to facilitate the relocation of the IDPs so they can resettle peacefully back in their homes. Some IDPs at the Protection of Civilians site in Bor say they want to return to their ancestral homes so their children can go back to school. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song We Need Love by John Templar.
Mama, oh dear papa, yeah. Oh dear brother, oh dear sister, yeah. His message goes to you, yeah. His message goes to you from the bottom of my heart now. Why make your brother to cry? Why make your sister to suffer? Why make your mama to cry? Why make your brother to suffer? For time has come, everybody saw some love. We need love, love now. We need peace,
peace and unity.
We need love,
love now.
We need peace,
peace and unity.
We need love,
love now.
We need peace,
peace and unity.
And harmony, yeah. Live in peace and harmony.
We have been listening to John Templar with the song We Need Love. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We would like to know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also reach us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. We hope you can join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
For you and me to make some better changes. For it's time for you and me to make some better changes. But when the time is getting harder, we need to stand together. United we stand.